Mansfield's work explores history, place, time, and preservation. He has written 7 books, including In the Memory House, The Same Max Twice, The Bones of the Earth, Turn and Jump, and most recently, Dwelling in Possibility. Dwelling in Possibility is a search for the qualities that make some houses a home and some public spaces welcoming. Dwelling, Mansfield says, is an old-fashioned word that we've misplaced. When we live heart and soul, we dwell. Today, Mansfield will take us in search of the souls of our places and the possibilities of dwelling. I present to you Howard Mansfield.
Thank you. Good morning. It's good to be here, close to home, to talk about home, to talk about something we all know about, and yet we are, to differing degrees, blind or numb to. And it's home that I want to talk about, not housing, not affordable housing, not architecture, or mercifully planning. You're spared. I want to revive an old word that we've forgotten, dwelling. I want us to look at 2 questions. What qualities are missing from our homes, and how can we regain those qualities? I've thought about this on and off for over 30 years while writing about architecture, preservation, sense of place. It was really brought home to me when we're looking to buy a house during the hot fever of a real estate boom here in New Hampshire years ago. Looking at houses, I would stay long after it was obvious that it wasn't the right house for us, which is about 30 seconds. You know immediately if this house or apartment is for you. It's intuitive, it's a gut sense. You may linger to ask about the school district, to count the bathrooms and all that, but you know immediately you're out the door. Coming out of the house, my wife would say, "That was an awful house." Yeah, I'd agree, but did you see that little red furnace from Sweden? It burns wood, coal, oil, gas, tofu, Stephen King paperbacks. You could heat your house through January with just a few copies of The Shining. That's a great furnace. The houses we saw had the opposite of curb appeal. They had curb appall. I liked house hunting. I am fascinated by how houses succeed or fail to shelter us, body and soul. I could go from house to house, clear across the country, knock on doors, and ask, "Can I come in? Look around? What's your favorite room? Your latest house project?" I'd like to see them all. The sour living rooms behind dirty windows and overgrown shrubs, the small rooms made smaller by dark wood paneling, big fat lazy boy recliners, and large screen TVs. McMansions where rooms and rooms leak space. Prim places where the grass is edged, the shrubs are obedient, and inside the couch is under a plastic cover and the cabinet of curios is dusted and gleams at attention. Houses where the Bible and the baby Jesus are the only ornament and guns lie asleep in drawers and cabinets. Houses that are all noise, as if they were cotton candy spun from the loud, always on TV, and the radio giving traffic reports to the resident who doesn't drive. Houses that smell from the morning's bacon all day long, where one breakfast seems to compound the next, as if staleness were compounded daily, like old-fashioned passbook savings accounts. Houses that smell of feet are vaguely like diapers, even though the children are in high school. Houses you covet, so airy, so modest in their grandeur. Houses where everything seems to be right. Husband loves wife, cat loves dog, tree loves house, house loves view. Houses that are worn and comfortable, like an old fielder's mitt, like the sweatshirt and jeans the community executives wears on Saturdays. Houses that are mysterious in their blandness.
The rooms, the furniture set out as expected, as prescribed. But you know, no one really lives there. Where's the real life? This is a front. You want to see, and you don't want to see the private rooms. Houses that are walled in with photos of children, grandchildren, nieces, and grandnieces. The walls of diplomas hanging like battle ribbons. Houses that you pass 100 days, 1,000 days, maybe every day of your life, and no one enters. Even the lawn seems to be self-mowing, the mail self-removing. Houses that command a hill, houses that play hide-and-seek behind trees and shrubs, houses that seem vulnerable, exposed by a highway exit, on a traffic island, back into a big store parking lot or a railroad tracks, the house a goldfish bowl. Houses in which terrible things have happened in daylight. Houses in which nothing has happened, and that seems terrible. Houses where boredom sticks to the walls, yellows the walls like grease from 10,000 meals. Houses that grow old with their inhabitants, roof and walls, windows all flaking, peeling, breaking. The house has arthritis. The house is closed to the world. Houses that spill out toys and bikes and cars and tools and projects, sometimes right to the line of their neighbor's land. Thousands, millions of houses. You drive past them at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., all those people asleep, snoring, dreaming, all in the dark, trusting in the state that no marauders will come in the night. All houses are mysteries. In all houses, we're struggling to live the life we should. We're confined, cluttered, slothful, or ambitious, planning, rebuilding, self-improving. In all houses, we are hiding out from the neighbors, from the world out there, from the world in here, from each other, from ourselves. The mystery that holds my attention is that some houses have life, our home, our dwellings, and others don't. What I want us to look at this morning is why this might be. When does a house truly shelter the soul? To discuss this, we need to revive that old-fashioned word, dwelling. When we live heart and soul, we dwell. When we belong to a place, we dwell. Possession, they say, is 9/10 of the law, but it is also what too many houses and towns lack. We are not possessed by our home places. Dwelling has left our buildings. We have housing without dwellings. We have Home Depot, but not home. This lost quality of dwelling, the soul of buildings, haunts most of our houses and our landscape. In this flip that house era, there's little talk of dwelling. Meanwhile, we go on building anti-dwellings, bad houses, depressing waiting rooms, miles of roadside slop, and all of it with due deliberation, and all of it to code. We build thousands of houses, but only a few homes. With the world's population projected to double, we'll have to build this world all over again. How can we do that and shelter the soul? At the gym where I work out, warding off creakiness, I see those home decorator design in a whirlwind shows. All the shows, no matter the channel or the premise, are the same. Hope lies in quick fixes, in bold paint schemes, mirrors, cutesy photo displays, contrived twists of fabric. But the space is just usually bad. Dim rooms as narrow as a single bowling alley. Rooms in which every door, window, cabinet, and light switch is in the wrong place. This is just renovating deck chairs on the Titanic. The shows are about dolling up a house to compensate for how unsheltered people feel. These shows deal only with surfaces. They are working in a long tradition of faux finishes and false fronts. As a 19th century architect, Leopold Eidlitz, said, "American architecture is the art of covering one thing with another thing to imitate a third thing, which, if genuine, would not be desirable." The real problem isn't the window treatment or the clutter by the door. The real problem is that too many of our houses are no longer dwellings. We have shelter from the rain, snow, and sun, but our houses aren't sheltering our souls. They aren't nourishing. We treat houses as investments or as social policy problems, as in the statistical Sahara of the housing problem. The soul starves. We're in our house, but not at home. Our dream houses lack room for us to dream. Samuel Mockbee, the wizard architect who started Alabama's Rural Studio, in which architecture students design and build homes for the poorest of poor, as Samuel Mockbee said, everyone, rich or poor, deserves a shelter for the soul. Dwelling is a question of qualities. Ordinary graces, if you want to be fancy about it. These ordinary qualities are being squeezed out of our houses. So, okay, how can we see these qualities? Two quick examples, one ancient and one modern. First, the hearth. For thousands of years, we lived with smoke and fire. When we moved indoors, we moved the campfire indoors, first in an open pit in a large hall, then we put the fire under a hood, then in a large fireplace, some big enough to walk inside, then a small fireplace, as redesigned by Count Rumford and others. Then we put the fire in a box, a wood stove. And then the fire, for most of us, was exiled to the basement. And the hearth, the center of all home life, vanished. This great divide, so obvious in the telling, was brought home to me when we had that devastating ice storm in 2008. As many of us here recall, or don't want to recall, more than half of New Hampshire was without power for as long as 12 dark December days. We gathered around our old Vermont Castings wood stove. We lived by the fire. The sounds, light, and very essence of our old house changed. Its older, pre-electric self emerged. The circle of the home contracted around the fire. The old campfire reasserted itself. We were thrown back to an ancient ordinary, chop wood, carry water, and this ancient ordinary sleeps in our houses. We were returned to something essential, and that can be seen in the origins of the word hearth. Hearth is derived from the Old English for the place where the fire is set on the ground. Our houses have lost the connection between fire and earth. Focus is Latin for hearth. Our houses have lost focus. When the house has been unhearthed, how do we remain at home? As the hearth has disappeared, we also face another change that has diminished the qualities of dwelling. It's a siege, an invasion, a pile of piles. It's clutter. Ours is an age obsessed with clutter. There are clutter coaches, support groups, awareness groups, National Clutter Awareness Weeks. Even TV shows where you watch people throw out stuff. There is, of course, an entire decluttering industry. Clutter is the cholesterol of the home. It's clogging the hearth. The clean sweep team from the television show of that name usually hauls away about a half ton of trash from each house that it rescues from clutter, which may explain why 23% of Americans admit to paying bills late because they can't find them. Those are the ones who admit to it. And why 25% of people with two-car garages have to park their cars outside. This is a complete inversion of our history. At the founding of America, houses were small, about 700 square feet, the size of a two-car garage. And they were jammed with people, but few things. You might have a bowl, a spoon, a table. Colonial America was a land of small, crowded houses. Each household had many people, but few possessions. The average family size was 7 or 8, 12 or more people, relations, servants, hired hands, slaves, and that includes slaves in the North, would live and work in maybe 700 square feet, maybe 500 square feet or smaller. And in the North, this was reduced when rooms were closed for the winter. People slept alone in a bed only in sickness or childbirth. They ate in the room where the family slept, often sharing utensils, passing around one dirty pewter mug, eating out of one pot. Birth, illness, and death all took place in a small house. Home and work were one, but in quite a different way than from today. Everyone worked to grow food and make clothing. The family was colonial society. The family was a business, trade school, weekday church, hospital, orphanage, old age home, welfare institute, and even a house of correction, as sometimes criminals were sentenced to work as servants in other houses. These houses would offend our senses today. You could say that they were cluttered with smells,
chamber parts, lye, manure from the fields on boots, wood smoke, pipe tobacco, souring milk, ripening cheese, and sweaty inhabitants who didn't bathe. Flies, bed bugs, and lice were common. Filth and slobbiness were everywhere. The aisles of a church and meeting house would be fouled by dogs and chickens that wandered in and out in warm weather. Men in church, even those in the choir, would spit tobacco juice. Not that I'm advocating for any of that. And now we live in huge houses with few people and heaps of stuff. Per person, we live in 10 to 14 times more space than our colonial ancestors. 10 to 14 times more space. And people still have to rent storage sheds. There are 51,000 storage facilities in the US, more than four times the number of McDonald's. One in 10 households rents a unit. And it's kind of telling that they're called that odd thing self-storage, as if people were storing part of their identity and not just a lot of crap. Not that anyone is judging. The decluttering industry is ready with advice. Lists, actually. All decluttering books and websites are lists. The shortest of the lists are reduced to acronyms like SHED or LIFE, and I'm not making this up, which stand for SHED. Separate treasures, heed the rest, embrace identity from within, drive yourself forward. You got that? And then there's life. Lighten up. Invest in comfort. Forget perfection. Enhance flow. I've been working on my own acronym, SLOB. Stop buying junk. Less is more. Out with it all. Husband or wife, if that's what it takes. Bliss or bag it. Depending if you're reaching for awareness or just want a chance to see your desktop floor or chair again. Follow these clutter gurus, and one day you're in a messy house that's jammed with broken toys and orphaned exercise equipment, and the next day a summer breeze moves through a sunlit, sparsely furnished, white interior with room for a thinner you to sit on your yoga mat and drink green tea as orange-scented candles burn and little feng shui mirrors twinkle. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a yard sale, Chairman Mao might have said. We know what clutter displaces, and that's why we're obsessed with it. Clutter displaces the solitude to recollect ourselves, the time for families to talk, all that which makes up the humdrum, nothing much that is home. We are losing that nothing much. Clutter is choking our shelters. Is there any room left for ourselves in our houses? This is the place to talk briefly about another kind of housekeeping, the kind of housekeeping that seeks to tidy up the world, the kind of housekeeping that makes up some reform movements. I want to talk briefly about the reformers' agenda for village improvement and how it remade Peterborough in the era before World War I to the early 1920s. The Peterborough we see today is a creation of do-gooders, of a small cadre of village improvers. They had a distinct idea of dwelling, of what home should look like, and what made up a good home and good town. Our local wealthy reformers were progressives and at the same time conservatives. And I won't even attempt to unravel that seeming contradiction, except to say that part of the progressive movement gave us child labor laws, the 8-hour day, the Pure Food and Drug Act, workman's comp, forest reserves, and it outlawed corporations donating to political campaigns. Long story there. Part of that movement was liberal, even radical, and part conservative, and historians have been tangled up in the contradictions ever since. Peterborough's progressives believe that the world is moving to a higher level, as they said. They believe in creating what they called a higher civilization. They took what was just another New Hampshire mill town, tore down mills, one still actively producing, one with prospective tenants, and built much of the red brick colonial Grove Street, the first American Guernsey Cattle Club building, the Historical Society, and the townhouse. For Peterborough's progressives, the colonial past was the real New England. And New England, a region then in an economic tailspin, New England could only be revived
if it returned to the principles of the founding fathers as they saw them. In the village they created, they saw the virtue of old-time values, that an idea of the colonial past which placed the family farm and local tradesmen at the center of a hard-working, honest republic. For these village improvers, I believe, mills making textiles or shoes or woodenware were alien, an imposition, an attack on small-town virtues and the whole family gathered by the hearth. The Peterborough we see today is the result of ambition, cultural renewal, reform, and a veneration of the hearth and dwelling. Those signs that you see coming in the town, a good town to live in, could just as well say the progressive era lived here. Let's look at one more quality of dwelling, one I search for by going door to door. And it's one of the most important aspects of dwelling. I worked for the last census. When I became a census taker, I filled out reams and reams of forms, went up back roads, posted with a dozen no trespassing, keep out, this means you signs. It was a great pleasure. I met angry young men, wary folks, and many people, most actually, who I went over to chat. On the last day of our census training, we were sent out on a sample canvassing operation. With two other trainees, I covered a small triangle of an old village with houses that dated to the early 1800s. A few houses were well tended, but most were coming apart as if they'd been hit by invisible tall waves. Storm doors with broken glass, porches piled with junk, porches kneeling to the earth, ready to pull away from the house, paint long gone, bad repairs, windows covered with blankets, and home improvement projects given up so long ago that the plywood had grayed and the white Tyvek wrap was flapping in the breeze. At each house, when someone answered our knock, I was impressed by the way people appear at the door. Their whole being and presence arrives along with the breath of the house's odors exhaling upon you. On these late winter days, it was like seeing a turtle sticking his head out of his shell. I've had this experience before. I've worked as a door-to-door salesman. I've delivered the mail. Knocking at a stranger's door, you're at the threshold of other lives, right at the line of privacy. Two people told us that they had sick people in the house. One woman was a little too quick to tell us that she didn't have any additional apartments. We all thought she did. Each home was a mystery. Just what were people doing in there? In truth, I had signed on wishing to conduct my own private census. What I wanted to ask the people who came to the door was, so how's it going with you? I mean, really, not income, not the size of your house, but how's it going with your soul? The census that I wished to take was Gaston Bachelard's. The philosopher would remind his friends and students to dream well. I tried to judge houses on what I called the Bachelard Index. Are the people here dreaming well? Are these houses nourishing the souls dwelling there? We should be building good places for dreaming. After basic shelter, this is what matters. The rest is home decor. Gaston Bachelard was a French Sorbonne philosopher and the author of a book you've probably seen around, The Poetics of Space. It's a great book if you skip the introduction. It's a book you can daydream along with. In that book, Bachelard says, a good house is one that's good for daydreaming or reverie. All houses are houses of dreams, said Bachelard. We live in houses, and so we dream houses. We daydream there and daydream about them. They give us the shelter to enlarge ourselves. They are the vessel in which we go forth into the universe. A good house is a good daydreaming space. It is the universe, he says. It is the council of continuity. We are created by our reverie, said Bachelard, for it is reverie which delineates the furthest limits of our mind. Imagination works at the summit of the mind like a flame, he said. Bachelard courted reverie. He was a daydream catcher. For this reason, Bachelard was a French national treasure, and he was eulogized as a teacher of happiness. So many things in my trips as a census taker, looking for these qualities that Bachelard had to offer. And some of the most troubling houses to me
were summer houses that were all shut up and waiting for the people to return. There were a few houses where I lingered, well-sided old farmhouses with views of the hills sheltering under big, thick maples, old cabins that even in winter held their summer poise. In deep snow, I trooped around on snowshoes among a group of rustic shingle-style cottages by a small lake. No one was around but me and the ghosts of a century more of summers. On broad and saggy porches, worn wicker chairs and tall back rockers sat gathered in a circle as if still in conversation. There were faded paper lanterns, abandoned mosquito coils, and bug spray. My favorite cabin was sheltered in a grove of birches. From the porch, the lake revealed itself demurely, glinting between the trees. The summer houses, humming to themselves the tune of another season, had an arresting grace. They were at ease. This began to trouble me. They posed an entirely different set of census questions. Why do summer places have the signs of home, big trees, prospect and repose, but daily houses often look worn and beat? Is this a chicken and egg question? Were these houses chosen as a summer place because they were special, or are they just curated differently? Someone's pet, someone's dream of New England? Do we trample the gentle qualities of home place with our daily comings and goings? Or are modern houses just graceless? The old houses belong unquestionably to their place, and too many new houses are just set down. What I learned from my many censuses is that all houses are provisional. No matter how much brick, stone, and wood we erect, no matter how much family history we wrap ourselves in, a dwelling is a temporary encampment. The houses that seem the least temporary are the ones that are settled each day, in which each activity binds the people to the place, planting or building, or being in a way so that house, land, and people seem to be breathing at the same rate. But if we're not here, then our homes are not here. The old farmhouses surely were here. They had no choice. And it's that here-ness that is pleasing. But these days, it seems that we're running short of here. We have a heap of now, but it's a placeless now. Old houses are brimming cups of here. As I walked around, I came to wonder about the possibility of dwelling in the ordinary. What would it take? Why is it that the ordinary is so hard for us? Not the 9-to-5 daily slog, but the grace of the ordinary. The world is a cup running over with grace, and we walk about parched. Well, so far I've given you daydreams, fire, clutter. And that's an unusual collection, I admit. But they are each important signposts. By urging us to dream well, Bachelard is giving us permission to feel at home, to dwell, as we wish. And while the hearth was certainly about warmth and food, it was also the very community of home, the permission to let talk drift, to tell stories, and the strong conviction recounted again and again that this was the center, the heart of home. And clutter, well, that's about things displacing life. That's about our time-obsessed, time-hectored present. Daydreams, fire, and clutter. We're still not quite there. Let's look at an extreme situation, because it sometimes takes a disaster to show us what's important. In disaster, we cling to shelter. We get back to essentials, and that especially includes the central qualities of dwelling. I saw that in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. I volunteer for Habitat, like quite a few people here, I'm sure. I worked on the house in the 9th Ward of New Orleans, and I became a specialist in nailing on the Simpson hurricane strap. It's supposed to keep the roof to the walls in case of a hurricane. I was working on a shotgun cottage near the corner of Law and Piety Streets. I love the way they name the streets down there. I'd be up there in the rafters, hammering away, tap, 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 looking out on just miles of destruction. Tap, 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 another nail, looking out on miles of destruction. It was just overwhelming. What would one nail do? Just overwhelming. And then I went to visit someone that I think many of you may know, a photographer from Peterborough who dropped everything to volunteer with the Red Cross right after the hurricane, Annie Card. And when Annie saw that more needed to be done, she didn't just come home. She and a friend set up a relief agency called Mississippi Home Again. And they handed out appliances, beds, hot water heaters, swift and direct help, a perfect model of pragmatic compassion.
And at my visit, a year and a half after the storm, this is a year and a half after the storm, Miss Annie, as she was called down there in the Southern Way, was still there working to build and repair 100 homes in 100 days in a poor Mississippi neighborhood. When Hurricane Katrina hit Pascagoula, Mississippi, three waves raced in. The first was a 20-foot storm surge. A wall of water two stories tall, driven by winds of up to 145 miles an hour. The waves washed 13 miles inland, flooding more than 90% of this small city. Along Beach Boulevard, when the waves receded, they took with them houses that had stood through Audrey, through Camille, through all the hurricanes by which people here mark time, hurricanes by which children mark birthdays. I was born after Frederick, a child would tell you. The first place Miss Annie showed me was Beach Boulevard, where the town's grandest houses had once stood. Along the beachfront, there were steps and pillars, cement slabs. No houses. They weren't leveled by big wrecking cranes and carted off. They were just here and gone. We get out of our car, we walk up the rise to the front steps, and that's all that's visible at first, the steps and the old trees. A closer view reveals a small field of wreckage, a brick pile that had been a chimney, stubby brick piers that had married the house to the earth and the back steps. And there underfoot are bits of the former life, a corner of a marble tabletop, smashed pieces of good china, a delicate pattern of gold and pink and white, a rusted flashlight, a boot scraper for the doorstep made of horseshoes for good luck, shards of colored glass, a garden hose still wound on his plastic dolly, standing next to a spigot from the remaining tangle of water pipes, and an intact cookie jar that says, after school cookies. The cookie jar is in the shape of a house. Only the roof lid is missing. I take in the intimate scale of this destruction. A storm that is hundreds of miles across may smash one teacup and leave another behind. This was personal. All morning I'd driven past ruins along the Gulf Coast, but I'd seen them only at a huge scale. Hundreds of crushed motel rooms, concrete and mattresses spilling out like a waterfall, the footprints of vanished stores, houses, and gas stations with their telltale pipes marking the end of now-gone gas pump islands. I was inadvertently compiling a field guide of the lost. But this is the most poignant Katrina monument I have seen. On the back steps is a display of broken flea market, pieces of cut glass bowls and dishes, an elegant glass, probably for some kind of after-dinner drink, little bits of blue glass, a rusted and twisted coping saw. This is an altar to the vanished domestic life. After Katrina, Annie tells me, she would see people picking through the ruins of their houses, setting pieces aside. Whatever little they found, they left. They were living in a FEMA trailer or living with their relatives. They had no room for any of it. That's what they said. Maybe it wasn't what they had hoped to find. They had hoped to find a way back to the day before the wind and the waves hit. Taking a piece of china or a soak photo back to your trailer could be a bitter souvenir. It's what we all fear. The forces of the earth, wind and water and fire, and the ground itself bursting open, coming down upon our family, our doorstep. A house is a small boat. A wall is the thinnest of envelopes, no matter how well built. We know that we will vanish, that everything we have and hold will turn to dust, but we don't want to believe that. And we certainly don't want to see it all go in one shake of the earth or one wave. I look out to the Gulf again just for relief. The view from under the old trees to the silver-toned water is bewitching. I look down again around the foundation. Someone has mowed this lawn. Someone is tending this ruin. Oh, yes, says Annie. She came by here once, a few foundations down, and there was a man trimming the weeds away from his foundation slab. His house is now about 3 inches tall. When I first got here, she says, if I had seen it, I would have thought he was crazy. With all that needs doing, why do that? But Miss Annie understands now. You do what you do, what you have to do to restart your life. Let's stay with this scene for just a moment, with this man tending his foundation slab, giving loving attention to this absence, this house that is no longer there. This man is still dwelling there.
Even though his house has been crushed by wind and waves, smashed to pickup sticks and washed away, the little that remained, that foundation, still sheltered his soul, because we need to dwell. Now take that one man and multiply his longing for dwelling by thousands, by hundreds of thousands, and you begin to get a sense of the long, painful aftermath of that big hurricane. And we often look right past this elemental longing to dwell. That first Christmas after Katrina, Annie told me, convoys brought in hundreds of thousands of dollars of toys. But she said, the kids didn't want toys. Ask them what they want, and they say, I want Mama to stop crying. Ask them to draw, and what do they draw? They draw a house. And they don't want a dollhouse, she said. They want a house. They want to go home again. It's what everyone wants. It's what that man tending his foundation slab wants. The Mississippi Gulf Coast is like the land of Oz. Everyone is trying to go home again. There is no place like home. But after Hurricane Katrina, your home is like no place you have ever known. I hope that you're beginning to see that dwelling is our main occupation. Or as Emerson said, how to spend the day nobly is the problem to be solved, beside which all the great reforms which are preached seem to me trivial. I suspect he'd be a hard house guest to have. This gets to the root of our fascination with house shows and house hunting. To go house hunting is to dwell in possibility. But just what is that possibility? One is that we'll be a new person in a new home. Given a fresh start, our better selves will rise. That's part of the answer. But the real possibility we seek is habit. It's the ordinary. We want room for the mundane. This is not what we ask real estate agents or builders for. We ask for great rooms and upgrades, granite counters, stainless steel appliances, luxurious spa bathrooms, and walk-in closets the size of Wyoming. But we should ask, give us room for tumult and quiet, for solitude and passing the time with friends. Give us room for ordinary pleasures, for a day well lived. We should be hunting for the ordinary. I've used that word ordinary quite a lot this morning. And I've said that to restore dwelling, we have to restore certain qualities to our homes. And now it's fair for you to ask, yes, but what is that quality? Name it. You've talked about daydreams, silence, clarity, clutter, the hearth. Those are good examples. But name it. With those examples, I've been trying to talk a little bit about the animating spirit that enlivens dwelling. The architect, Christopher Alexander, author of A Pattern Language, calls this animating spirit the quality without a name. Christopher Alexander writes, "The search which we make for this quality in our own lives is the central search of any person and the crux of any individual's story. It is the search for those moments and situations when we are most alive. What matters most cannot be named. What persists is eternal and elusive. Try to name it and it's gone. We can speak with allegory and example, and then bravely admit that to get ourselves in the vicinity of this quality without a name, we need to simplify. We have to restore the ordinary that lives in the shadows. It lives in the spaces in between, which the Japanese call ma, not in clutter. We need to give ourselves room to be. We need less. These are old arguments, but more urgent than ever. We have to start over again as beginners at dwelling. There's no magic formula. There's no handy checklist you can fold into your wallet. The quality without a name can never be a polished monument. It can't be a bumper sticker slogan or a soundbite, but it can become our guide and practice. It's not too late. The qualities await us. We can dwell in possibility. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. While the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this. In your book, there's a chapter about many different kinds of sheds, but you have an unexpected definition of a shed. Could you tell us a bit about that?
I should just say, Michelle, since I just finished saying it was unnameable and elusive, I think we should all just sit here quietly. Why smother it with more words? Yeah, in the book, I end up by talking about sheds because they're the most ordinary kind of building, and they're one that's really common to us here in New England. And I don't just mean bob houses and wood sheds, I mean barns. I mean meeting houses, which are basically just a shed for worship. All these buildings are very plain, they're very flexible, and they deceive us by going on from generation to generation, why fancy buildings for single purposes are built and then just discarded. These buildings adapt and adapt again. They kind of stand back and let life flow through it. So that's what I mean by sheds. We're actually doing a photo book about different sheds, horse sheds, and all beautiful, 32 different kinds of sheds. And Joe Morrissey, who some of you know, who's a photographer at the McDowell Colony, she's been out all over New England shooting, and it looks terrific, and it should be out next month.
Can you talk about this dwelling, the church, and how that fits into your ideas of dwelling?
Yeah, we're very fortunate to have these old kind of spaces that are made of very simple materials. There's probably, three, four, five, six different kinds of materials in this building that would not really be up to modern code. And they have a real peaceful feeling largely because of that. I think there's spaces that allow us to dwell, to be really peaceful in. And you see that in some of the old meeting houses too. It's a very fortunate kind of thing, and it's a kind of thing that if we can just restrain ourselves from altering it too much and just step back and let these spaces be, we can kind of really tune into them, I think.
What impact does technology play in dwelling?
Oh, everything. let's go back to the example of the hearth. When the fireplace was lost and the wood stove came along, which gave a lot more heat, and the cook stove, which gave a lot more heat, there were tremendous lamentations about the loss of the old fireplace, and houses seemed to stop breathing, and people really missed the hearth. And Catherine Beecher Stowe and her sister, Harriet Beecher Stowe, wrote this book, which is really like the first, I think it's called The American Home Companion, right before the Civil War. And they go on and on at length about the loss of the hearth, and they say, you know, Washington and his men did not suffer at Valley Forge for a fire in an enclosed box. So... And then you had the opposite. Edward Everett Hale's mother said, oh, just be quiet. While you were out poetizing, I was here tending the fire all these hours, and I am happy to have anthracite coal. It makes my life so much better. And stop with this nonsense and this nostalgia. Each time a technological change comes into the house, it completely upends everything. And right now, that's what's going on with how our houses have become more permeable to all this digital information and digital technology and work coming home. And it's a similar kind of thing.
Could you please comment on the growth of trophy houses and RVs? Mobile houses.
Trophy houses? Oh, we're all for trophy houses. Next question. The average size of the American house has gone way up. And around the 1970s, it was about 1,500 square feet, long about... Today, it's about 2,400 square feet. It kind of stepped back maybe 100 square feet during the last recession and started to grow again. And so what we're doing is we have this kind of two things that are kind of going on a parallel track. We're building larger houses for fewer people. And we're having all sorts of different people saying, well, wait a minute, this just doesn't fit. I need to downsize. How can I do that? I've got this large house here. I'm starting out. I don't need this large space. How can we make co-housing? How can we look after the elderly, how can we look after the sick? But we're still kind of stuck in this trap of building one kind of house that we have built since after World War II. And that's a continuation of that. There is a hint, I think, in northern New England for a more flexible house. If you look at some of these old houses, these old farmhouses, big house, little house, back house, barn, over the course of their life, they changed tremendously. They would have one huge farm family, then they'd be divided up into apartments, Then they might be divided into a few apartments and they might come back together. But the house, you could see the house over the ages, kind of breathing and contracting with what was needed. And it's that kind of flexibility we're really looking for now that we haven't yet found our way to.
Could you take your talk farther and talk about the role of animals in the land in relation to dwelling?
Animals in the land, who could have asked that? It definitely is part of what draws us to the old houses. It's part of what really obviously, it's so obvious to say it now, tied people there. You had to be there for your animals at all times. It's what changed the land. Anytime you put an animal on the land in great quantity, domestic animals, it changes everything. And there's definitely a certain feeling that's lost when you look around the landscape at the empty pastures and everything. It's a big change. My wife says she didn't ask that question. Okay.
Is the quality which cannot be named defined by the materials found within a dwelling or the activities that take place there?
The answer for 20 points is both. I think some of you know Christopher Alexander's books, The Timeless Way of Building and A Pattern Language, or you've probably seen them around. They're two like little yellow bricks of books, and they're fantastic. Borrow them. If you borrow them from someone, you're probably not going to return them. But anyway, that's what happens to them. And you could read them as a poem and a celebration of what it's like to live on the earth. And what Alexander's saying, this started in the 70s in Berkeley, Alice Waters' time, out there. And he said, he and his cohorts there said, what makes a living space, what makes a place alive is a series of patterns, and each pattern relates to the next. And he says, and this is a great way of looking at things, there are no things so much as relations, as patterns. It's not a chair, there's a relation of parts that make up a chair. There's not this building, but all sorts of little patterns of how we enter it, of the way the light comes in, of the quality of the materials that make up this building, and how this building relates to the street, and how this building relates to the sidewalk, and so forth. And so in the pattern language, there's 243 different patterns, almost like roaming around a walk across the city. He says, that's what we've lost in all these unpleasing spaces, that we've lost the sense of building patterns, we're pattern blind. But if we see that it's really about relations, then we know it's not just a fence or a path, but the way that path shoulders close to a building, and the way that path passes this fence, and the way that fence relates to the house, and the roof of the house echoes the church roof. Now, we're really alive to this when we travel, like we're in Europe and taking all those goofy pictures, and those places, those old places, are all of a piece, the ones that survived the bombing of World War II. And we're conscious of hundreds of years of counterplay, of echo, back and forth over the whole thing. So this quality without a name, which he says, it's about wholeness, but it can't really be named. He says it's built of these patterns, it's built of these living centers, and we have to give it room, and we have to pay attention to it. And he says also that it's very hard to do and very hard to find. And he says in the average building, there's like 50,000 ways to make a mistake. I think, I'm not saying he's the answer to everything, absolutely not. But it's a good way to kind of get us past the way we look at the land and buildings today.
Can you imagine a public school classroom as a dwelling?
Wow. I think there are, I have a very good old friend from middle school years who's a teacher, was a teacher in Vermont. And you go into her classroom, and it was like a dwelling. There were animals and all sorts of art, and you just wanted to stay there. And you went, this is a small school in Vermont, you went to the next classroom, which belonged to a principal, and it was very institutional and very cold. And you did have a sense of spirit, of anima, of life there. So yeah, I could see that, I guess.
Can't what is a home vary widely by person?
Absolutely. We rehearsed that for hours.
Can you comment on the tiny house trend?
Yeah, the tiny house trend. I think we all love reading these articles about these millennials who are living in 200 square feet or 250 square feet and have to build their house on a little trailer with wheels because it's against zoning code. And we're all going, wow, that's amazing and good luck to you and can I check back in with you in 2 years? Particularly, there's often couples starting out together like this. But I'm beginning to suspect we are seeing the same three or four little tiny dwellings in all the magazines. I think it's a trend. I think it's a very small trend. I think it's, again, this kind of thing that's trying to push against the McMansion and the large-sized house. But I don't think we're all going to be crowding into tiny dwellings soon. I think a lot of us started out in very small apartments and have fond memories of that, but aren't really looking to go back to it.
Can you give an example of a public space that exhibits qualities of dwelling, a place that you have visited or we could visit?
Yeah, there are many. I'm going to give you a very simple example. In the town where I live, Hancock, there was an old dirt path running along Main Street, and we had this whole Main Street committee to look at redoing Main Street, changing everything but not changing everything, you know, is what people wanted. Change this, change this, change this, but don't change anything. So why would a dirt path be important? And it gets back to that idea of patterns, and it's this whole sense of what's alive and what really lives there and how that path was made by a lot of feet finding the right way across. And you can go up the scale to public squares, to great streets that you're just excited to go down. They're chaotic, they're noisy, there's all sorts of things going on. But again, if you go back to that idea of patterns, just a lot going on.
If it is not too personal, could you tell us what makes your house a dwelling?
Yeah, you know, we have a very just typical big house, little house, back house, northern New England house built maybe around 1880 under some old trees. We've just let it be. I think we're the only people I know of who've moved into an old house and didn't knock down a wall. I was taking an inventory the other day. Just let it be. You just sort of let the house teach you what it's like to live there, and you're just so much better off in the long run. So what makes it a dwelling for us? There's so many qualities. There's so many qualities of sitting out under the old trees during the summer, of coming home and finding my wife there, of just a sense of letting the place kind of unspool. We have a barn with some chickens. We used to have a big pig, a very big pig. A very, very big pig. There's just a lot of qualities there.
Thank you again, Howard, for sharing your time and your expertise with us today. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at monadnocklyceum.org. The program next Sunday will feature Marjorie Hines speaking on Sex Wars to Red Scare, a Civil Liberties Odyssey. Thank you, Howard, for a wonderful talk. Now, please join us for more time with our presenter and for some refreshments in the parish hall, which has been most generously provided by Summerhill Assisted Living. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the Hancock Library and Allison Kerwin of the Enchanted Garden for today's flowers, and Eric Blackmer for doing our sound recording. If you asked a question that was not answered during the program, please feel free to ask it during the reception. We'd like to hear from you about your experience today, and we encourage you to fill out the blue card. Thank you so much for coming today and making possible this lively dialogue.